interesting why kids pick colleges.
So what does that say about how you teach them?
Food.
Yeah.
Yeah, food is a big one.
Food is a big thing.
At least you didn't say that you look like Dumbledore.
That's true. Sounded like it. Actually, I wouldn't mind sounding like it.
Gotta change the whole song.
I think I'll go ahead and start. Greetings, my name is Petter Jothen. This week I'm sort of leading conversations around the issue of consumption, and particularly relating those issues of consumption to sort of Christian practices and sort of thinking about how we as Christians can sort of both critique and resist and enjoy in some ways what life has to offer in terms of God's good gifts. And so today I want to talk about happy endings and other myth consuming stories. And this isn't super focused, is it?
Yeah, there's a way to focus.
It's gotten worse, I think, actually.
Has it gotten worse?
I'll let you work on that type of thing. I'm not much help. And in particular, we're going to actually talk about The Little Mermaid.
Yes.
So I'm hoping some of you are familiar with it, though I will summarize it. But up to this point, we've talked about consumption in relationship to our earnings and wealth and possessions. And we've also talked about in relationship to corporate branding. And I know not all of you were here, and my sessions are designed not to necessarily relate to each other, unless you bring that to them. So today, instead of things, per se, instead of material possessions, I want us to think about stories. And to me, one of the profound things about stories, and I know Craig is here, not just stories that are on the silver screen or on TV or in books, but also theater, is that they present ideas about what is the good life, what it means to be a good person. And in many ways, what draws us into certain stories is our own relationship to our ideas of what's good and evil and what it means to be a person and what it means to act in this world. And that's sort of what I want to explore. In some ways, we're consuming ideals. We're consuming ideas of the good. We're consuming ideas of ourselves. We're consuming ideas and thinking about what it means to be a good person. What makes life meaningful? Where do we come from? What's the purpose to all things? Those kinds of things. This session also, for me, comes out of a viewing of the vow. Does anyone see the vow? The Vow is a movie this past spring with Channing Tatum, who is also in Magic Mike, who my wife loved. Magic Mike's about strippers, no strippers. And Rachel McAdams. And it's the story about a woman who has a traumatic brain injury and forgets that she was married to someone. And it's based on a true story. The movie has these two attractive people, they fall in love, they get married. And when they get married in an art museum. Because they're funky and they're hip and they both talk to each other and their vows they write. And vows are pretty much, I will always love you no matter what. And that friends take pictures, and the underlying montage underneath has happy music that sort of sets the marriage in this beautiful, funky hipness. And of course, then she has this traumatic accident. She forgets that she was actually married to him, and the whole movie is sort of talking about that struggle of the relationship. Well, it's based on a real event, which I actually know very little about. But the real event was written about by the couple who the movie's after. And they said that the reason they stuck together was because of their faith in Christ. So the true story, if you want to call it that, is a Christian tale about their relationship to God saved their marriage, despite the fact that she couldn't remember that she was married to him, or remember him at all. What did Hollywood do? Got rid of all the religious elements. Here are these funky hipsters. One's an artist. One's an architect and one's an artist. Care about arts and beauty and those kinds of things. They get rid of the Christological dimensions. And I think, to me, it raises kind of fascinating questions about the stories that we receive pretty much daily. I mean, how many people watch television, watch sitcoms, dramas? How many people watch movies? I mean, we're in an age where we consume these daily. We relax by them. And the question for me is, how do we as Christians, who in a lot of ways are called by God to be formed by a particular story, then ask to relate and think about and critique these stories that we receive through sort of popular culture? And so that's what my hope is what we will do today. So the first thing I want us to do is I'd like to turn to your neighbor. And I did this last night, and I asked you to turn to someone you don't know. So if you could find someone you don't know, and I'd like you just to 2-3 minutes, think about a story, either a book, play, movie, that is important to you. Be any story, I'm not. And think about why it might be important to you. And I'd just like you to share that between the two of you. That's good, introduce yourself too. Did we share something, or at least think a little bit? Last night I started up the session by asking the pairs to share how much they earned. That earned me a lot of stares. When I said this one is a lot of bubbliness. Tells you it's a different topic. So, anyone want to share what you discussed?
Yeah. I heard about Peter Pan. That is, I mean, at least for me and probably for most of us, is a story we know at some level. And it struck me just,
Lynn,
as Lynn was sharing that story, how that one is maybe to some extent both with us individually and collectively, and our missing of what can we hold on, what do we lose as we move out of childhood.
So innocence and naivete and playfulness and fantasy.
This place is reminding me of childhood.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Hold a minute. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you can make the fairy houses then.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Great. Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other experiences?
I'll share my partner's story. She was telling about a book called Birds Without Wings, which I think is also very relevant to Holden, because it was talking about a village in what is now Turkey where Armenians and Orthodox Jews and
Orthodox Christians
were living together and managing and intermarrying now and then, mm-hmm. and finding richness in that life. And then the war came and the politics blew them all apart, and I don't know the ending of the story, but I think when I hear that about the small scale of a place like Holden, or of maybe life a while back, and now it's so big and political, and makes it harder to.
So maybe visions of community, visions of relationship and connection that are both found and lost, and sort of the tragic elements to just sort of our life.
We talked about story of journey, and so because The Hobbit is coming out this winter, I had to, even just last week, revisit the film trilogy, and so there's nothing like The Lord of the Rings in terms of good quotes, one of my favorite moments is when Gandalf and Frodo are sitting in the Mines of Moria, looking at the two are possible choices. I think there's three choices, total choices. And Frodo says, and I wish I could quote it correctly, something to Santa, I wish the ring had never come to me. And Gandalf's response is, we can't choose that. What's the line?
So do all who live to see such times.
But it's not what we, it's what, how we respond. It's what we do with our time that matters. And so the fact that whole trilogy is such an amazing journey story about calling, dealing with what comes to you and how you're going to respond. And then my other favorite scene, of course, is when Frodo and Samwise are on the hills of Mordor. And he says, I cannot carry the ring for you, but I can carry you.
relationship,
with
journey,
yeah,
great, great.
Call, all those things.
Great. Responsibility, great.
Addiction.
To the ring, to power, greed.
Power, greed, money,
addiction. Yeah, absolutely. With the ring.
Strong addiction.
Yeah.
It is incredible.
Yeah, sure. That's good. Other thoughts or was this a sort of an easy exercise for most of you? Anyone found this really difficult?
To say why?
Well, not to say why, but to come up with some story that mattered to you.
For me, there were many.
Okay, so many. So the it's a plethora of options. Now, I think. I'm glad that's the case, because that's my assumption and my own experience.
It's not always.
But I want us now then to think about where story leads us. Each of us has a story. We're born, we make mistakes, we have successes, we have events and experiences, we have struggles, we have growth. In a lot of ways, what we do then is we sort of make sense of ourself, make sense of who I am or who we are through stories. You know, and I think the vow again, the shock moment scene, we've tried. I know it is. I'm not really sure. You know, I don't know if, Chuck, is there someone from Media Ministry who could come help focus this a bit? Or can you do it? This, we can't get this to Zoom or focus or
blurry.
So, thanks. what? Shh. Brother-in-law. Can do that. Stories matter. And I think it's one of the reasons stories in film, stories in books, stories on television, I think they matter. It's why they appeal to us. It's why we go to them. It's why we think about them. It's why we think they matter to us. Because they resonate with us, and they resonate with our experience in terms of how we are made up. And so what I want to do here, too, is sort of do a little scholarly move. Stanley Howell Ross is a Christian ethicist. He teaches at Duke University. And his claim, and sort of how he does ethics and how he thinks about what it means to be Christian, is...
Wow.
And there was my
question.
It's like listening to Pickle Jones.
Nice narrative.
Wow. That's a much better story.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Ooh. Maybe we should just have Dave put on a show. The magic of the video machine. PowerPoint presentation.
Deus ex machina.
Yeah. His claim is that the self, each of us, is best understood as a narrative. That we are each stories. And that we understand ourselves, we make sense of our place in a culture, in a community, in society, by thinking about ourselves in storied form. And he then makes a further claim, and he says this, that the unity of the self is therefore more like the unity that is exhibited in a good novel. Any thoughts about this quick quote? Maybe unpack it a little bit.
Something that captures your attention.
Okay. Say more, I'm not quite sure.
Well, in a good novel, there's parts of that novel that you can remember forever.
But it also implies a good novel. What makes a novel good? Which is a vastly dangerous question. But did you, or a good movie, for that matter. Why Lord of the Rings? Anyone?
Captures your attention.
Captures your attention, okay. So part of it is some type of appeal to who you are. You know, attentiveness, yes.
Some kind of like
cohesive theme. Cohesive. The unity. I think this is what I really want us to make sense of. Unity.
But a good novel has one theme, and somebody's life is more a meandering story with differing plots and themes that don't...
Well, actually,
different than a novel.
My favorite novels have multiple themes. that somehow intertwine.
And somehow connect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're... But, I mean, like, you get novels that don't seem like they have a lot of, you know, like, a lot of cohesiveness, and they seem like really, really, really all over the place, especially, I don't know, more recently, like within the last 70 or so years.
Okay.
So, I mean, and I think that's people trying to make novels be more like sometimes how we see our lives, and like more like the kind of craziness and all over the placeness.
Yeah, but don't you think we try to come up with some
pattern
or deeper narrative that frames the craziness?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in our minds we try to make our lives, like we try to look at it like we see a novel, which is, you know, with like a beginning and a middle
sure.
end and everything, you know, kind of like falling
into place.
Doesn't
fit perfectly.
But that's not really how it is.
Sure.
And I think a good novel, as when I hear a good, hear the story of a person's life, it, maybe not their intention, but it gets me to ask some questions about, deeper questions about my life.
Which I think is a reflection to having a good character that you can follow and relate to.
Sure, absolutely.
I think that's what I always look for.
Sure.
Does this quote have a rest of the quote? Like, it's more like the unity that's exhibited in a good novel than like the unity... is he distinguishing?
No. I mean, he's not a...
Well, no, are we distinguishing
sure.
between different kinds of unity here?
No, I mean, his point is that it's this... This is sort of the further element of the quote that I'm just summarizing, because it goes on and on and on, like we academics do, is that what unity here implies is that there's some type of integrity, some type of... I don't... particularly like the sort of energy, like wholeness, some sense of sensibility, that you have some clarity of person, a clarity of who you are, a clarity of self-identity and self-definition, even despite the fact that there are these different streams in your life and different gifts and different struggles and different elements that, and frankly, ever-going change. I mean, hopefully none of you are the same person you were when you stepped off the boat. Concern by your experience at Holden has already slightly changed you. I mean, partially that's what Holden is asking of you. God is demanding of that. Yeah?
One of the reasons I want to define a good novel and to reflect self, I guess I mentioned Lord of the Rings, and I just have this very strong interest in what I call speculative fiction, or maybe future fiction or fantasy fiction, but I use speculative to cover kind of the gamut. Because it removes me from a traditional setting that I understand.
Sure.
Traditional, you know, I think like real, something real. And then I'm able to reflect on it from an outside distance and then realize, have it show up to my face like this and say, oh yeah, now I really see what that is inside of me. So when I say a good novel, one of my favorite types is that kind of novel or that kind of story, a speculative futures, type fantasy story that teaches me about myself.
So it matters for who you are. And I think that's really the burden of this type of claim here. I mean, part of it is multiple personalities. Think about multiple personality stories. They have different stories. They have different characters. They make sense of themselves in the world at different times in different ways. And we would define that as unhealthy, unwhole, fragmented, broken. And I think the burden of this claim is saying that all of us strive for some type of integrity, some type of unity of the self, such that when I act, I know why I act. That I know my place in a community in which I act. So did you have those?
Yeah, just related to the speculative fiction. We just finished a book called Zaytoon, which is about a Syrian man who lives in New Orleans during Katrina hurricane. Remains in the city after the waters breach the levees. And so, like speculative fiction, his worldview changes dramatically. Whoever expects water to rise up into the second floor of the house.
Sure.
And
sure.
So he's doing good in the city by remaining. He's got a canoe, and he's rescuing animals, and he's taking care of his neighbors, and all of a sudden his world changes dramatically while the flood is there.
Interesting.
And, so anyone who's interested, it's in the Holden bookstore, actually, Zaytoon, Zeitoun.
So why did that particular story appeal to you?
What did it do for me?
Yeah, or why did it grab your attention?
I think in light of what you were saying, sometimes you have to be in a fantasy world to kind of look at yourself. You know, things change dramatically. And I was thinking, also, you can look at nonfiction, you know, when the world changes dramatically. And for me, I thought the main character is doing good. You know, he's living out his life as he would, whether there's a flood or not. Circumstances continue to change, and all of a sudden, how do you respond? In that kind of adversary.
And to bring this back to sort of the overall theme of this session, I mean, these are acts of consumption. We're consuming ideas, we're consuming concepts that we then relate to our own experience and our idea of who we are, and frankly, our communities. And my question, you know, the session is sort of driven, is how do we do that to stories that might conflict with the Christian story? How do we do that with differing accounts of our origins and meanings and purposes? And frankly, how do we enjoy them too? And I have been using John this week because of the Bible studies about John. Mary Emily isn't doing 10:10, but it still relates to living waters here. And this quote, which someone brought up actually this morning in Bible study, that I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I mean, in a lot of ways, Jesus here is saying, at least in this context, in this frame, that what is life? It's this unity. It's this integrity of character. It's a willingness or an ability to make sense of who we are as we grow, as we struggle, as we deal with death, as we deal with success, as we deal with challenges, as we deal with hopes and fears and aspirations. And I also think here it's about abundance. And abundance to me is laughter. It's crying when we need to cry. It's caring when we need to care. I mean, the whole gamut of the human experience. It's not just, let's say, moral perfection or something like that. But it's really a sense of, okay, I can live and share and love and cry and be both in myself, this sort of unity of myself, but also with others in a deep and profound way. And I to me, it's also been really interesting. Unfortunately, Marne's session is going on concurrently. I mean, a lot of what she's doing in her healthcare sessions have to do with the communal nature of what health is. That our communities have broken down. And as a consequence, people are unhealthy. That there's this link between the two. And, I mean, again, it's unity here. Integrity, connection, relationship. And according to person we're using, Stanley, here, it's stories matter then in our communities, both in terms of how we see ourselves and how we grow and make sense of our actions, but also how we fit and make sense of our communities. You know, I don't think it's that much of a leap to look at some of the American mythology about all these great Christians who came over and were uber responsible and wrote the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution so that, guess what? This is a Christian nation and God wants us all to be responsible. You know, part of that myth, which isn't historically accurate, but it's the story we some people tell about this nation and their place in the nation. So what is the story? And I actually was trying to use some of the terms that Craig had used in his first session. But as Christian, our story is a frame of God's story. And this is a sort of an analogy that is kindly worked out, so there are probably problems with it. But Craig, on Monday, talked about what theater was, and he said that there's an actor, there's the audience, there's the author, and then there's the auditorium. And so what I thought, for us, who's the main actor? God. God created things. God is still involved in our lives. We believe that. That in the Spirit, God causes us to deep and calls us to deeper relationships with each other, with God. So God is author, is creator. God is the main actor who calls us to a certain type of life, to a certain type of existence. And ultimately, the story the author is giving us too is about being made right with God through faith in Christ. Sort of our response to the story. in some ways, we are actors. We're not really the main actors. I mean, we could take it further here. God is also sort of the audience. But I think that raises lots of other theological questions. But we're actors, and for God, the story that we hear from God, especially in the Lutheran tradition, is that we're both sort of under the law and under the gospel. We're both being judged for not being right with each other and with God. At the same time, God tells us we are right with God. And that's the wonderful tension in the Lutheran tradition, that we're in this in-between, as I call it, that we're both sinner, we're both saved, we're both. And the problem comes when you think you're saved and forget you're a sinner, or vice versa. And we inhabit this middle ground. We inhabit that in-between. That's our act. That's our story. That's how we make sense of our successes and failures. That's how we make sense of our callings, our vocation. And the auditorium is something that the Lutheran tradition calls the two-realm tradition, which there's this external world outside of us. And the external world is the economic system, the political system, the social system, the wider community outside of church, and inside the church too. It's our family. But we're also inner beings. This inner-outer experience, these two communities that we're a part of. And both of them are united through God's story of Christ. Both of them then sort of fall under law and gospel. Both of them are seen in light of the Creator. I mean, this is the story. This is more theologically rich in terms of its story nature. And where does it come out of? It comes for us as Christians, the Bible. And I put this up here because this is, ironically, one of my daughter's favorite books. Through no fault or responsibility of me or my wife. Which, yes, would you say that?
Yeah, we hate those cartoons.
And it's obviously not the whole Bible, but she'll pick it up, and she loves the David and Goliath story and Noah. Okay. But the Bible then is sort of in this view of doing theology and thinking about ethics and whatnot. The Bible reveals God's activity creation, ordering, fulfilling creation. It goes from Genesis to Revelation. Some parts are more storied than others, but they're all framed by God as author. And I put a quote from Mark 1, beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I mean, most of you probably know what Mark here is talking about. Yes? What is it? It's the story of Jesus's, not in Mark, but Jesus' birth, at least in the other three synoptics, or two synoptics and John. You can debate whether the prologue is the birth story. But you probably know what the good news here is, yes? But it's not just facts. It's not just events. It's sort of the pattern of a life. Even Jesus deals with rejection. You know, he's kicked out of his hometown. People don't listen to him. He's kind of crucified. The Gospels tell the story of Jesus. And I think one of the reasons the Gospels are so profound and so confusing and so frustrating, it's why we go to Bible study, is because they're stories. And there's so many layers. And those layers speak to us at different times, in different periods of our life, in different contexts, different communities, that we go back to that well of living water. To use some of the themes from Mary Emily's session. And what do? I think we do exactly what Zaytun. You know, we relate it to who we are, to Lord of the Rings. We relate it to who we are. And we start to see ourselves in the story. Because guess what? This story is about us. It's not speculative fiction. It's faithful stories, which is complex and crazy and confusing and full of highs and lows and full of emptiness and joy. But that's who we are. That's how we make our sense of ourselves. So stories matter. And we sort of live out this story in our church. mean, our liturgy and sort of how we pattern our worship comes out of the story. What do we do when we preach? I think good preaching has a narrative dimension. Reminds us of that story, calls us back to the themes in the story, calls us back into this life that we have in God's story.
Peter, can I raise a question?
Sure, Mike.
So I just, maybe this is looking at things, but you just said this is not a speculative story. And maybe just in the, just thinking out loud here, thinking in the sense that sometimes I read the story, it seems so incredible that I think I do look at it as a speculative story, and I see the challenge as what if, or
sure,
what if sort of that, sometimes there's the idea of living in faith, well, let's just live as if
sure
that story is true.
Sure.
And so I think at times this story can challenge me as a good speculative story can challenge.
Yeah, maybe that's the wrong choice of word, speculative. I'm sort of relating it to your definition, I think, which in a little rings is the sort of, you know, we could spend probably all morning figuring out exactly how to define it.
Yeah,
I mean, I was trying to relate it more to the idea of faith. Faith,
okay.
I mean, faith is not certainty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not faith against certainty. Faith sort of against doubt. They're always the brother and sisters combinations. I always think about them. You need them both. Faith without doubt isn't faith. It's sort of empty. So we have this story. The story has been told for 2,000 years. And we, in our context, because of, you know, the beauty of pluralism, the beauty of diversity, the beauty of the popular culture and the mass market, is... yeah, the marketplace full of stories that we can consume. So in a lot of ways, A, there's different accounts of making sense of the Christian story. You know, I'm sure most of you have heard of, what's his name? The guy from Growing Pains, Kirk Cameron. Kirk Cameron. You know, he's putting out all these Christian films that sort of are fireproof. It was the most recent that I know. They come out of a very evangelical worldview in which the Bible is sort of quite literal in terms of how he takes it. He's also been involved in the Left Behind series, which has been profoundly influential in certain communities in this country. You know, there's different accounts. Which one's right? How do we know? There's other religious stories. Islam, the Buddha, Hinduism. I mean, anyone read the Rig Veda? I mean, they're fascinating stories about, like, one of my favorites, I had a cat once, it's my roommate's named Holland, and he was a monkey god, and one of his stories is that he formed a number of islands in Southeast Asia because he was hopping, and he had semen leak out of his penis. And the semen hit the water and caused islands to sprout up.
Sounds like a movie.
Sounds like a movie? Well, I can see why it's
a movie. It's a great idea for a children's picture.
Get on there, Kayla.
I will.
Get on there, Kayla.
I will.
You know, so there are, and we live in an era where books and stories are readily available. These aren't hidden. These aren't. And in a lot of ways, because we, as Lutherans, we live in two realms, the reality is we're part of this world with diversity. We're part of this mass market culture. Here's Hollywood and mass media. I mean, it's really easy. And I'd also say popular culture is ubiquitous. I was in the Moroccan Sahara because I took a bunch of single students there about 6 years ago. And it isn't quite the same, but someone got a cell phone call on their cell phone while we're on camels going out into the desert. Wi-Fi, 3G, 4G. You can watch Netflix pretty much anywhere in the world. What? Just not at home.
It's not at home.
Well, but for those of you who are members of the communities, that's a big issue. Internet technology, should we, because my siblings lived here for a while, and you could get internet in the dorms, or dorms, in the lodges and chalets. And what could you do if you got internet? You watch Law and Order. Probably, you know, go very slowly. But, you know, and we're sort of at the beginning of this era of this radicalization of technology. You know, we can consume it anyway. So here we have this Christian story that most of us here identify with, and yet it's just one story among many for many of us, or for large parts of our culture. And I think about my daughter, who's 3. You know, this is our context. This is our reality. So if we as Christians say, let's be centered, let's be formed, let's participate in God's story as our story, well, but there's all these other stories out there. Especially for the younger generation. To me, this is one of the bigger issues of the church. We also watch more things. Right now, it's the highest it's ever been, 151 hours per month per person, according to Nielsen. This was 2008, and they use 3 screens, movies, internet, or TV. 151 hours of some type of programming a month.
Probably now that includes phones, I would imagine.
Yeah, the smartphones, that's even gone up.
Yeah, I think in 2008 that wasn't quite
right. We didn't have an issue.
So are they saying everybody's doing that? Or
this is their statistical polling. You know, that this is sort of the median consumer. You know. So I think it has profound implications. I think the church too. How do you deliver a church? In fact, this is a story of my wife's, that when she was teaching at St. Olaf, there's one of her students who wouldn't go to any church in Northfield. Instead, wouldn't she dress up to or not? She'd sit in front of her computer on Sunday mornings and watch her church's internet broadcast as a means to participate in her. Pros, cons, and you can both see, you can see both sides of it. Give you a question? Just thinking. So we have a marketplace of stories. And I've sort of very generally sort of tried to think about movies in particular, but some of the underlying values that I think many of the movies and stories that come out in popular culture talk about. And one I call the mythic. And what's a mythic? It touches on meaning and the origin of human existence. Anyone see Prometheus? I am literally preaching to the choir. It's not. Prometheus is an alien prequel, and it starts out with a story about how humans were formed.
And how did you watch that?
On the internet.
on like legitimate internet?
Well, it was legitimate internet, but it was a Russian. Russian pirated version.
Torrents.
Which is its own session, really.
Was it Torrents?
I could not watch that movie because it was rated R, and I could not take my daughter that wanted to go see that movie. So I said, I will not go.
See? What a good choice you made.
Apparently, we have a conversation about this. Yeah, right.
Star Wars, I put up there too. May the Force be with you. Yeah. A couple of us were talking about it earlier. This is my generational's mythic movie. Good and evil, you know, darkness, light, father, son. I mean, all these archetypes. Lightsabers.
And maybe an important point to make is based on George Lucas's deep conversations with Joseph Campbell on archetypal stories and things like so very self-conscious.
Yes, absolutely. It's mythic. He intentionally wanted it to be a myth. He wanted, because he didn't believe his kids had fairy tales.
Yeah.
So he wanted to make a fairy tale for his kids.
Create those.
Wildly successful, obviously. Mm. I also then sort of thought about the heroic, which was power of human capacity to overcome. Avengers. Anyone seen Avengers? Just made like $600 million.
Whoa.
I mean, we're talking about lots and lots of money here. And then the room. Bridesmaids is kind of romantic comedy.
If you take a look at ratings and moneymakers and that kind of thing, movies like The Avengers, movies like The Harry Potter, they're the top movie makers, and I think it begs the question why. Mm-hmm. What is it about those particular stories that feed into our sense of
hummingbird. It wanted to answer your question.
It did. But I think those are the worlds as we wish it would be. And
yeah.
We hope it would be.
So part of it is aspirational.
It's the good versus evil and good winning. Well, that's the archetype. Good wins all the time.
Yeah.
With some, you know, shades of whatever.
It's more ambiguous than this. My favorite endings are, you know, more bittersweet, a little bittersweet, not just everybody high fives at the end.
No, but right.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm just saying that, and there are, like, Harry Potter has its dark moments, as I'm not saying, but I'm saying, what is it about those mama stories we just crave?
And I think you're absolutely right. There are, certainly are movies that complexify and challenge us. But
those
if you look at the ones that make money, the ones that are wildly successful, the sort of the archetypes, and frankly, the movie industry too is now less focused on the US market and much more the world market. And what is it selling? It's selling these kind of ideas. And today I'm hoping to have some time to talk about happy endings being sort of one of the mythic components more broadly construed. So with that, I want to move on to The Little Mermaid, and suggest that it's about selling, it's about profit, these movies are. It's not actually about providing an accurate description of our lives. And from a sort of Lutheran sense, it's sort of false gospel. Yeah?
Well, I mean, don't most people watch movies for escapism?
Well, that's a great question.
I don't know. Is that a bad thing?
I'm holding for the same reason.
Well, when it's a children's movie, didn't think the escape room was especially forgivable, wouldn't it be? Like, I'm okay with the mermaid not dying at the end of the Disney version of the movie. Not making the little kids cry in the theater.
Well, okay. You know, part of this implies that you are centered in some story that you are able to view it as escapism. And I don't think that's true for everyone. And I also think it begs the question about sort of youth ministry and how we form the future of the church, who live in a world full of stories, where they can consume different stories pretty much nonstop as long as their parents don't let them or prevent them from doing it, or they move to Holden and can't use the internet at all.
One of the new group of books that came out that my daughter just devoured, as well as I think every kid in the industry, is The Hunger Games.
It is
just taken, you know, and it's something in the future again that I don't know anything about it, but my daughter can totally tell you everything.
That's good. Yeah,
that does not have base against spoil anything, but it's not the same thing as The Little Mermaid.
No, that's for sure. But. She falls in love and makes a decision. I don't think that's giving anything away.
No, probably not.
If you start the Hunger Games at all, it deals with some of those same struggles.
And that would be made $1 billion, didn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
It's unbelievable.
You know, I think another aspect of mass media culture, the aim is to sell happy ending. I think it's also an attempt to isolate us from that integrity that Carlos was talking about, to sort of isolate us into, you know, you are not connected to something bigger than yourself. You are your own self, so that we will buy these other things.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the good side of that, I suppose, is escapism. And maybe escapism is a good thing. But again, it implies that you are centered in some type of story. It implies that you are escaping from something. And the issue becomes is, how often do you do that? How do you sort of find that critical distance such that it is just an escapist experience? So either you can critique it such that you can say, well, this doesn't really fit in with my experiences. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, I do think that that's a challenge for the future of the church. I think it's probably less of a challenge for most of us who are a little older and have been formed, but I still think it's a challenge. So there's a hand up.
Just a story I was listening to on NPR that seemed somewhat germane to this, just quickly about successive movies. We've been talking about, you know, box office gross, but actually the safest kind of movie to make, much more so than any other, is like a Pixar animated movie. Like that is because, not only because of what it'll make at the box office, because now they do extraordinarily well, but the fact that they'll buy, kids will, parents will buy DVDs, and then you're watching it.
Toys.
So it's this thing of not only do you get bored often as a kid, of you can read The Hunger Games, and you may even read it 8 times. People might. But I bet you'll watch that movie.
Yeah.
You're much more likely to watch
that movie.
And
they do have action figures.
And you can play it out as,
Hunger
you know.
Games. So did Star Wars.
Yeah.
Only a lot.
Yeah. So did Toy Story. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's across the board, too, in terms of the ideas that are contained. I think it could move out to consumption of things, yeah.
I think a lot about the aspect of meaning-making, mm-hmm, for yourself and the media. And I think, I'm just thinking about what is going on with this mass culture. I think there are a lot of people who live very meaningless lives and have very meaningless jobs. They're not connected to stories, you know, many parts of America are very unchurched. Maybe they're more spiritual. The Northwest is like that, maybe more spiritual than church. But I just think a lot when I'm going to a movie, I'm looking for some reflection of meaning and quest and not really overcoming, but maybe courage or something vital to my life. I am not looking for action and power, mm-hmm, and greed and, you know, the things that I think they're selling to a very base,
sure,
part of,
sure,
our being.
Sure. And it works.
And it perpetuates, mm-hmm, I think, this idea that if you can't be a big player in life, in reality, you know, you're nothing. You have no voice. I was looking at that word. So I try to be very careful about what I go see. I'm completely uninterested in things that, mm-hmm, overly simplistic or overly power-oriented, which a lot of it seems to be.
There's no question the dark side of the moon of these kinds of you know, like the monolith type stories is you can get very sexist images and ideas, and you get very racist, mm-hmm, images and ideas and all that kind of thing. But I still think there's something that must happen in, mm-hmm, the core of who we are.
Well, I think it's also true that they make up our world, and they're not going away. Mm-hmm. And so, partially, what I'm asking us to do is really be engaged in self-critical reflection about culture and our place in culture and how we participate in the forms of culture. Because we do. I really like Band of Brothers. A war movie that was pretty hard to watch. I think The Pacific is even worse. The Pacific was about the Marines in World War II. And for me, it was hard because my grandfather was in the Pacific in World War II and landed in the second wave of Okinawa. You know, and never talked about it, that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you're sort of repulsed by these war images. It also draws you in because of the heroic quality to what's going on and these normal people, sort of like my grandfather, who risked life and limb in a way that I never had.
What about The Hatfields and McCoys? Did anyone watch that? It was
was on History Channel. It was a three-part miniseries.
I think it was the highest rated series in
history. Oh, it was fascinating.
It's not also popular because you don't relate to it. Like,
yeah, right.
It's so
But yet there was a draw. It was some tough things to watch, but I just kind of...
Yeah, both this repulsion and trying to find value in it.
And then the fascination with the real piece of it, what's real. I kept going back to, of course, the internet to find out what really happened versus what was in the movie.
Sure.
Let's talk about mermaids.
Well, the case study I did is that there was a dude named Hans Christian Andersen. Everyone familiar with him? Mm-hmm. Everyone heard of The Little Mermaid, at least the Disney version?
I've heard of it.
So Hans Christian Andersen sort of originated the tale of The Little Mermaid. And Hans Christian Andersen was Danish. He wanted to be a serious author, but he was not taken seriously by the Danish presses, and so he ended up sort of making money very despondently with his children's stories. But most of his children's stories at least have overt religious themes or, frankly, Christian themes. And so The Little Mermaid, it's really a story of death, God, and immortality. And basically, mermen and mermaids do not have a soul. And so you have The Little Mermaid, she is one of the sixth sister. She wears oysters. And she says they hurt. And her grandmother says, pride must suffer pain. And she rises to the surface. She sees a prince on a ship. The ship is shipwrecked. This is some of the overlap with the Disney version. And she saves the life of the prince, but he doesn't remember her. And so what she does is then, is she goes and she asks sort of a sea witch to turn her into a human so that she can go and win the prince's heart. And in order to do that, she loses the voice. And if she doesn't do it, she will turn to foam. Mermen and mermaids, they live for 300 years. And then they die. And she, part of the theme here is her reflection on why do humans seem to understand what death is where we don't, because we just die. Because humans have this immortal soul that helps them. So she can gain this soul if she gets the prince to love her, basically. Is sort of the point. So here she trades the voice, there's the prince. But she fails. The prince does not love her. He thinks his fiancée is actually the one who saved him. So the sea witch gives her a choice. You can kill the prince and get your body back and voice back, the phone thing. Or you'll turn to foam. And so she agrees to kill the prince. So she goes up next to him and sort of comes up with a knife. He's sleeping and she can't do it. But then these angels show up and they sort of give her the option of spending 300 years sort of floating around with the angels and sort of helping people do good in the world. And this is actually how it ends. I don't know why this did this, but so in 300 years, we will sail like that into God's kingdom. The we here is all the angels that she's now a part of. We might get there sooner, one of them whispered. We float invisibly into people's houses where children live. Every time we find a good child who makes his parents happy and deserves their love, God will shorten our trials. A child won't know when we fly through the room, but if we can smile with joy at the child, a year will be taken away from the 300. But when we see a naughty and mean child, it makes us cry tears of sorrow, and every tear adds a day to our lives. Pedagogical, I mean, it's...
This is meant to be written.
Yeah. I mean, but death, immortality, knives, blood... Any responses initially to this?
I would beat that story.
Yeah.
Cautionary tales.
Well, here's the Disney version.
I've seen this.
She really does love him, doesn't she, Sebastian?
Well, it's like I always say, Your Majesty, children got to be free to lead their own life.
You always say that?
Oh, then I guess there's just one problem left. And what's that, Your Majesty?
How much I'm going to miss her.
So on the one hand, part of what we've been talking about is sort of how these stories in our marketplace of ideas are often selling us happy endings. But behind that, too, is the appropriation of sort of deep, dark, religious stories for profit. I mean, Little Mermaid was wildly successful. In fact, I was surprised how many people... I'm not surprised that most of you had heard of the movie Little Mermaid. I was kind of surprised how many people hadn't heard of the Hans Christian Andersen version. And I think this does raise questions about what stories do and the stories that we experience and what stories are we reading and how do we both sort of entertain ourselves and enjoy this? Because to me, that's what abundance is, that this is kind of funny and quirky and it's got some nice songs and it is about love and we all want to experience love. But how do we then sort of see it for what it is, as a vehicle for profit? At the same time, we see it and enjoy it. So, of course, it's now noon. I would be glad to talk further, but if anyone obviously needs to go, then please feel free. But Jeremy? Oh.
I would just mention one thing. There's a fabulous book that you may have heard about by Bruno Bettelheim, who's a child psychiatrist, who wrote a book called The Meaning and Uses of Enchantment. He kind of dissects the Grimm's fairy tales and Hans Christian Andersen's. And he's talking so much about the purpose of deep tales, these tales that have survived for millennia, are to help children understand how to, I'll relate it to my power concept, how to relate to dark forces and manage in a world in which everybody is bigger and doesn't make sense and, you know, crazy. It helps them in some of these that are fabulous stories like Hans Christian Andersen grapple with the ambiguity of life. This isn't about the God part, but about the story part. And if anybody wants to look at it, I highly recommend that book. I think it's fabulous.
What's it called again?
The Meaning and Uses of Enchantment.
Great
it just,
title.
Especially for what you're doing,
yeah.
You know, teaching about this, it's a lovely way to think
great.
About the what we should be reading our children.
And I know a lot of the fairy tales too. Like I think the original Cinderella has like the Cinderella like killing her parents, which is why she ends up with her evil stepmother. And they're even relative to the Grimm versions, the origins of all those are even darker. So obviously the Disney-fied version is completely saturated with happiness. And
is there any value to Hansel and Gretel? Like they don't learn a lesson really, other than to talk to strangers. Because they'll cook you in an hour. They don't run away. They get abandoned.
They don't. Oh, they do.
They get abandoned in the forest.
Well, it's poverty.
But they do figure out how to get away.
By throwing the old lady in the oven.
So that's metaphorical. I mean, it's not necessarily. Yeah, it's not necessarily reality. It's metaphorical. But they had to figure out how to overcome this witch that was trying to kill them.
Craig, you were going to say something?
Oh,
I was just reflecting that Disney's reimagining of the Little Mermaid is really interesting, contrasting that, you know, about 10 years later they made The Lion King, which was an original story with a lot of archetypal sort of journey and coming of age things. When they transformed that into a Broadway musical, they brought in Julie Taymor, someone from a very avant-garde regional theater kind of background, who took live actors and many, many African-American actors and gave them a lot of work there too, which you don't see in the original African setting of, you know, since it's an animated tale. And she used a lot of the sort of global theater techniques, which she is just a master of, in terms of large-scale puppetry and things like that. So something that seemed originally very nice, somewhat trite with the talking animals, becomes something very, well, we have a chipmunk in here visiting us. becomes something huge and magical and transformative in that way too. And also a blockbuster.
Yes. I've seen it. I'm amazed at how it stays.
It's astonishing.
I don't know if anyone's seen it.
Other thoughts? Begin again.
Thank you.